Political tensions escalate in the U.S. as Joe Biden says his transition to presidency is underway, despite Donald Trump's refusal to concede defeat. Official in charge of voter fraud investigations at the U.S. Justice Department resigns after Attorney General Bill Barr authorized federal prosecutors to probe possible election fraud. And the European Commission says the Brussels-Washington relations, which were strained under the U.S. President Donald Trump, will not be restored just because of one election. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, U.S. President-elect by media count, Joe Biden, says it doesn't really matter whether or not President Donald Trump accepts his victory in the race for the White House.
So I'm confident that the fact that they're not willing to acknowledge we won at this point is not of much consequence in our planning and what we're able to do between now and January 20th.
Biden noted that he and his team have already begun the transition process, adding, nothing is going to stop it. He also called Trump's refusal to concede defeat an embarrassment, which will not help Donald Trump's legacy. Former Vice President's remarks come as the Trump administration continues to refuse a Biden victory. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has ruled out the possibility of a transition of Donald Trump's administration to a new one.
Is the State Department currently preparing to engage with the Biden transition team? And if not, at what point does a delay hamper a smooth transition or pose a risk to national security?
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready. The world is watching what's taking place here. We're going to count all the votes. When the process is complete, there'll be electors selected. There's a process. The Constitution lays it out pretty clearly.
Pompeo said the State Department will do whatever necessary to make sure that the U.S. government will continue to perform its national security functions as it moves forward. Earlier, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell voiced support for Trump to pursue the case of election fraud in the courts. Trump's campaign has unveiled several lawsuits against election officials in Pennsylvania following similar suits in some other states. Campaign alleges that Pennsylvania's mail-in voting system lacked the transparency that in-person balloting did. Trump said he lost the election to his Democratic rival Joe Biden due only to fraud, but has offered no evidence to support that claim. Political commentator Frank Imspach believes that there could be social unrest in the U.S. if Trump continues to claim he won the presidential election.
Generally speaking, over the last 20 years or so, when you had a recount, and let's say there's 20,000 difference or something like that, usually the recount only results in a 400 or 500 vote switch. So right now, as far as anybody knows, from the legal perspective, there's nothing on the table that would cause anybody to say the election is somehow invalid. What's happening, I think, is a very dangerous situation. Because by refusing to acknowledge that there has been an election, that he has lost, and they keep talking about a smooth transition to the second Trump administration or whatever Secretary of State Pompeo said, that sets in motion potentially a situation of great social unrest. And I hope that's not what is going to happen here.
A top official from the U.S. Justice Department has stepped down in protest after Attorney General Bill Barr authorized federal prosecutors to probe possible election fraud. Now, Roger Pilger, who is the director of Elections Crimes Branch at the Justice Department, in his resignation letter, Pilger said that William Barr was revoking the 40-year-old policy of non-interference for ballot fraud investigations prior to elections being certified. On Monday, the U.S. Attorney General issued a memo allowing prosecutors to launch probes into what he called voting and vote tabulation irregularities. Prosecutors normally require permission from the Justice Department's Elections Crimes Branch to probe possible vote fraud before elections are certified. President Donald Trump has claimed, without providing any evidence, that his Democratic rival Joe Biden is projected winner due to fraud. And now the U.S. has imposed fresh sanctions on a number of individuals and firms over their alleged links to a U.S. blacklisted Iranian firm. The U.S. Treasury Department said the restrictions target four people and six companies based in Iran, Hong Kong, Brunei, and China. They're accused of facilitating the procurement of sensitive goods, including U.S.-made electronic components for Iran's communications industries. The U.S. Treasury says the company produces military communication systems, avionics, and missile launchers, among other items. The move is the latest by the Trump administration to ratchet up pressure on Iran. Tehran says the Washington so-called maximum pressure campaign amounts to no more than economic terrorism. Political commentator Jim Dean says that President Trump is trying to create hurdles for the Biden presidency in terms of its Iran policy.
I anticipated this, and Trump and his campaign telegraphed this already in the news, that he was going to spend the whole next month doing a whole range of sanctions on Iran. He was going to be very busy during what should be a transitional period, where he's handing things over and laying out, going into the background. He's wanting to, as part of his bitterness and losing the election, and then also while these court tests are going on until that silliness is over, he's going to, as part of his disrupting the Trump administration getting started up. So then he's also going to create Biden in, and by some of these sanctions, which I'm not sure of the legality, whether it's something that Biden can just reverse some of these new sanctions if he does. But I think another one of the reasons Trump's doing this is so that if Biden does reverse these sanctions when he takes office, the Republicans can then claim that he's going weak on Iran. And that he's not going to be tough enough like Trump said he was.
And now back to our top story, where there's still a lot of allegations out of the Trump administration with respect to vote fraud, and Donald Trump is getting his legal team out there hitting the courts from state to state to try to stay in this presidential race somehow. Joining us out of Miami for an update is our own Ronnie Curvello. Hey there, Ronnie. Go ahead, bud.
You mentioned before that some of the Trump followers were saying in the media that they do support whatever actions Donald Trump are taking in order to cancel some of the votes. So, okay, for those supporters saying that, but what I have is a position from different federal judges. In the case of Pennsylvania, the federal judge dismissed the request to stop counting. In Michigan, the judge rejected another lawsuit because they have no evidence. In Arizona, was another rejection. Trump's team wants to cancel some votes because some people use a different kind of Sharpies. In Georgia, the federal judge also rejected Trump's request because Trump's team wants to cancel some votes that was cast after 7 p.m. In Nevada, the federal judge also rejected a lawsuit there because Donald Trump wants to stop the county, the use of a machine, a verification machine. And that's perhaps the reason also that Richard decided to resign from his position, motivated by those decisions of those judges. And also, people say here, especially politicians from the Democrats, that this whole thing is happening because of Georgia. As you know, they are going, the two senators there, the candidates, they are going for a rematch, a runoff. And if the Democrats wins the elections in January the 5th for the Senate in Georgia, they may have control of the House. Remember, The elections in Georgia is January 5th. And the decision, the counting of the delegates, electoral delegates in the joint section at the Senate and Congress is January 6th. So the herbs, this whole thing, this whole mess is happening in order to motivate the Republicans in Georgia.
Interesting. That's an interesting perspective I hadn't heard, but I want to thank you for sharing that with us. We're out of time. Ronnie Corvello joining us from Miami with a very valuable update there. Good reporting there, Ronnie. Thank you. Stay safe, bud. Now, the European Commission says that one election in the U.S. cannot restore Brussels-Washington relations, which have been strained under Donald Trump's leadership. Earlier, we discussed the matter in detail with our guests in our news review program. Here it is. The European Commission chief says the Brussels-Washington relations, which were strained under U.S. President Donald Trump, will not be restored just because of one election. Addressing EU ambassadors through a video link conference, Ursula von der Leyen said U.S. has changed over previous years and things cannot go back to the way they were before. She said although divisions can be bridged, some shifts in priorities and perceptions run much deeper than one politician or administration. However, von der Leyen called for a new transatlantic alliance in areas such as climate change and the digital economy under President-elect Joe Biden.
Our alliance is based on shared values and history, on a common belief in working together to build a stronger, more peaceful, and more prosperous world. And these goals will always endure. But in a changing global landscape, I believe it is time for a new transatlantic agenda fit for today's world.
Also addressing ambassadors was EU Council President Charles Michel. He also said the EU should remain vigilant not to react with euphoria to a change in the U.S. administration. Michel warned EU and U.S. interests will not always converge in a systematic way. EU-U.S. relations have suffered markedly under Donald Trump over issues such as tariffs and U.S. withdrawal from international accords and organizations. EU officials have been quick to congratulate Biden, hoping he'll represent an improvement in ties. And joining us now for this news review is George Zamuli, a senior research fellow from the Global Policy Institute, joining us from Budapest, and Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in Budapest with you, George. Always a pleasure to have you on. Your thoughts, I mean, I'd like to try to read between the lines. What's Ursula von der Leyen really saying there? Is she going beyond the Trump administration and basically blasting U.S. trade policy in the last two decades?
But she does raise an important point. This transatlantic alliance is a fraud. It's a museum piece, an artificial construct. Europe and the United States have very different interests and have very different agendas. And trying to maintain this artificial nexus with this lot of bloviation and hot air about our common shared values and so on doesn't really help anyone. Whatever else you can say about Donald Trump, he actually did raise the issue of what is the point of this alliance? Who are we organized to combat? Europe has its clear economic issues. United States has its clear economic issues. And as Trump raised the issue that fundamentally it's losing out economically by maintaining this artificial alliance. So, you know, with the Europeans, it's better be careful what you wish for. You might just get it. So if Europeans think that under Biden, they're going to have an administration that's going to caress them and say soothing things, I think they may well be mistaken. The Biden administration agenda may not at all be to Europe's liking. It wants to exacerbate its tensions with Russia. The moment that happens, Europe is the one that's going to pay a price for it. Biden administration will almost certainly get itself involved in Ukraine, which will only, again, antagonize Russia. It's very hostile to the Nord Stream, to gas, natural gas project, which again will harm particularly German interests. As far as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, I think the Biden administration is going to leave that one alone for a long time. They don't want to start antagonizing the Israel lobby in the United States. So if they think that there's going to be any real change from Trump as far as the JCPOA is concerned, they've got another thing coming.
Thank you, George. And Tony, I'd like to welcome you to the program now. Now, Tony, Ursula von der Leyen and Charles Michel, I mean, we know they both kind of, I mean, well, I don't want to jump to, I mean, it's kind of evident that they hated Donald Trump. So, I mean, they could, instead of showing that they're static, that he's leaving, they're, I don't know, they're more tepid when it comes to incoming Joe Biden, it seems. Why?
Well, I think they certainly feel that they've got more shared values, is this word that they use, with Biden, a new Biden administration than they did with Trump. And those shared values really are the same oligarchy behind the scenes, the rich and powerful, the banksters that are the deep state, both in Europe and in the United States. That's their shared values, is that they're basically in the same clique. Donald Trump, for all his faults, and he did have many, many, many faults, at least when he got up onto a podium, onto a stage, you knew that it was Donald Trump's words you were getting. But Joe Biden, he basically works on teleprompters and scripts. And if you want a Hollywood version of democracy, then Biden is the guy. You know, he's going to be the one that does that. I'm not so sure if George is right about the JCPOA. I mean, it's quite clear that there was, you know, quite a lot of campaigning around the JCPOA. Biden saying he was all for restoring it. In the run-up to the election, in the actual election period itself, around sort of August, September, October, November, not a lot of mention of it. But if you go back to July last year, Biden was saying he wants to renew the arms control treaty, the JCPOA. This is there on the record. And he said if Iran returns to compliance, we will rejoin the JCPOA. That's what he said. Now, he may not mean it. And, of course, he's got a little get-out clause in there, which is if Iran returns to compliance. And the Americans might decide they want to fiddle around with that and make silly, you know, pedantic points about it. But I think, you know, the ball is now in Iran's court, because if Iran wants to re-comply, go back, then they will have done exactly what Biden said last year, and the ball will be back in the Americans' court saying, well, we are now back in compliance, sign on the dotted line, Joe. But the trouble is, you know, since he's actually announced his election as the new president, Biden has not mentioned this at all.
Thank you, gentlemen, both of you, for showing up on the program. Always a pleasure to get both your perspectives. George Zambuli there joining us out of Budapest, and Tony Gosling there from Bristol. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. The coronavirus pandemic continues to wreak havoc throughout Europe, with the number of COVID-19 deaths surpassing the grim milestone of 300,000. Italy has reported its highest daily death toll since the 14th of April, registering nearly 600 coronavirus deaths in a single day. The Italian Health Ministry also reported over 35,000 new infections. Disease has now claimed a total of 42,000 lives out of the nearly 1 million confirmed cases in the country. UK also reported 530 new daily deaths, its highest toll since mid-May. So far, over 1.2 million confirmed cases of the virus have been reported in the country. In Poland, officials there say the country should be shut down if new cases surpass 30,000. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Hairavi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Hairavi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hairavi English Radio.
In the limelight.
Boris Johnson's government is investing only 12% of the funds needed to tackle the climate emergency and the growing threat to nature, according to a new report that will raise fresh international concerns about the United Kingdom's commitment to the green agenda. The study released before an expected major speech on the environment by Boris Johnson says ministers need to commit £33 billion each year of this parliament to green causes. So far, only £4 billion a year has been pledged. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalists Toby Helm and Robin McKee. The piece is titled Global Experts Question UK's Commitment to Tackle the Climate Crisis. Stay with us for more of Toby Helm and Robin McKee's article. Boris Johnson's government is investing only 12% of the funds needed to tackle the climate emergency and the growing threat to nature, according to a new report that will raise fresh international concerns about the United Kingdom's commitment to the green agenda. The study released before an expected major speech on the environment by Boris Johnson says ministers need to commit £33 billion each year of this parliament to green causes. So far, only £4 billion a year has been pledged. The report by the IPPR think tank comes as Prime Minister Boris Johnson faces increasing global pressure to act, most notably from the next US President, Joe Biden, who is committed to green causes. Donald Trump took the US out of the Paris Climate Accord, the Paris Agreement on Climate Change, but Biden has promised to rejoin it on 20th of January, the day he takes power. Next year, the United Kingdom will chair the Glasgow COP26 Climate Change Summit. It is seen by Biden and other leaders as a critical test of the world's determination to limit global warming. However, experts are concerned by what they see as the United Kingdom's lack of preparation, particularly since the COVID-19 pandemic, which has placed huge financial burdens on governments. Carsten Jung, IPPR's senior economist, said, "So far, only about a tenth of funds needed for the clean investment revolution has been made available. Scaling up investment and following the 10-point action plan can create up to 1.6 million jobs and bring economic opportunity to every corner of the country, whilst lowering carbon emissions and restoring nature and tackling inequality." In addition, the government's own Climate Change Committee recently warned that the United Kingdom is not on track to meet its interim emissions target for the fourth and fifth carbon budgets for the periods 2023 to 2027 and 2028 to 2032. The report also identified some critical areas for action. These would include bringing forward the 2035 ban on sales of new petrol, diesel and hybrid cars, an increase in strategic investments in the development of carbon capture and storage for industries such as steel, and much more investment in zero-carbon alternatives to gas central heating. Without these measures, analysts warn there is a danger the United Kingdom's net zero carbon target will not look credible, undermining its authority as COP26 host. For his part, Boris Johnson has promised to put a green economic recovery at the heart of his government's post-COVID planning, with pledges to boost greatly offshore wind investment. But in September, it emerged that the European Union-China climate talks, which were credited with helping to secure a breakthrough from Beijing, were attended by senior politicians from across Europe, but not the United Kingdom. The European Commission has called for the European Union to raise its 2030 target for emission cuts from 40% to 55%, compared with 1990 levels. China too announced it would set a net zero target for the first time to shift the world's biggest economy onto a greener path. Taken together, these moves have hugely raised expectations for the COP26 conference in Glasgow. Climate scientists have said if enacted, China's new target alone would reduce global warming levels by 0.3 degrees Celsius. By contrast, the United Kingdom has not yet announced any new 2030 target, but there are expectations that Boris Johnson may do so soon. This week, Johnson will announce details of his 10-point plan, including a repeat of his pledge to make the United Kingdom the Saudi Arabia of offshore wind. He will also highlight the importance of conserving and expanding forests to cut carbon dioxide and help wildlife. He's also expected to signal more support for the hydrogen economy to replace fossil fuels in steel and chemical manufacturing, and carbon capture and storage technology to capture industrial emissions. It is also likely that he will call for measures to speed up the development of zero-carbon alternatives to gas central heating, and possibly announce the creation of an investment bank to provide public funding to build zero-carbon infrastructure. For its part, the IPPR think tank urges government to do more in several areas, including improving the energy efficiency of homes and buildings, preparing them for a switch to low-carbon heating systems, and building new zero-carbon social housing, which could generate 560,000 jobs. Its estimates suggest an additional £8 billion annually is needed to achieve the decarbonisation of existing homes and buildings. On nature restoration, it says an investment of £4.7 billion is needed annually through schemes such as tree planting and peatland restoration across the country. This could also create 46,000 new jobs. In addition, it urges more sustainable public transport, including rail and electric bus services, could generate more than 230,000 jobs, whilst installing electric vehicles charging point nationwide could create 47,000 new jobs. Luke Murphy, IPPR Associate Director, said, in announcing the government's 10-point plan, the Prime Minister must significantly raise both the United Kingdom's ambitions and targets on climate and nature, and radically scale up the policies and investments needed to achieve them.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وبه نستعين إنه خير ناصر ومعين. To talk about how could we live in this world, there are many, many issues would be covered, but for me, some of them are so important, and I chosen one because it is crucial and plays the role of engine for moving forward. And that's the change happening in this world and our life. What is the meaning of change? How could we actualize the potential change in our life? What is the way for channelizing the change to be beneficial for ourselves? What does Quran say? What does Islam say in this regard? Is there any way prescribed by the Holy Quran to change or not? These are some issues I wanted to start with, and inshallah to go through that topic and reach some points. I don't want to take your time more, but the issue would be covered here is the most important issue that is always coming to a question, and it is under question all the time, and people from different expertise are interested in this issue. One of the issues that is important for changing attitudes is to see conflict, problem, difficulty as non-conflict. This is what some people who are practicing some peacemaking process in the world, they say this is conflict transformation process. Through that, they emphasize on transforming whatever is conflict to be non-conflict. This is something more than the previous step. At the first step, we see that this is the problem we have to tolerate. This is one attitude, the first one. And to be patient and to practice sabr before that calamity is not so high degree of patience. Allah will reward that patience, but not in a high ranking, high degree. There is something more to see that this difficulty and problem, bala, calamity, is not bala. It is a gift from Allah the Almighty to me. I see that problem as a non-problem. Difficulty as a non-difficulty. I see these are so pleasing because Allah is going to test me, to try me. Then the best patience for that leads to the best rewards of Allah the Almighty. So changing and transforming conflict to non-conflict and difficulty to non-difficulty. This is the other issue we can practice it. And the other one and the third one that is helping us to change our attitude toward problems and difficulties is to see Allah's satisfaction in whatever coming to us. In the two previous ones and steps, we just look at the problems themselves, but now we are forgetting about whatever happening to us, just focusing on God Himself. Oh Allah the Almighty, we're looking at your satisfaction and your anger. Whatever is going to satisfy you, it is satisfying me as well. So I am satisfying with the satisfaction of God, not my own satisfaction. I'm not important. I'm not seeing myself. What exists is Allah's satisfaction. Then if you practice that, you are practicing the best change. The best change happens in your attitude. You are shifting your approach from this materialistic world and the events happening and taking place in this world toward Allah the Almighty. Shifting from the earth toward the heaven. From the problems toward the mercy, toward the gift present of Allah the Almighty. If we can practice that, then change happens. Allah is changing whatever exists in the real world, but He is looking at myself. If I change my attitude, Allah will change the real world. Otherwise, change would not happen to us. We have to do some steps toward Allah the Almighty. To go toward Allah the Almighty, at least one step. The other steps will be taken by the power of God, by the mercy of Allah the Almighty.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here. Who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So I want to just refer to some tips in this lecture. Through that, we can change our way of life, our lifestyle, toward the best one. The first one in changing the way of life is changing the way and finding the new way of living. If you used to live one way of living, from now, decide to change your way of life. Whatever is beneficial for you, whatever is joyful for you, and it is the life of God's. Go toward God through taking new way. The others that are living around you are important in changing your lifestyle. Take care of them. Put emphasis and great look at them. They are coming, accompanying you in this new way. How? Care about their speech, their talks, judgment about you. Don't be sad about their judgment about you. Accept them as a gift from your brothers and sisters in Islam, in religion. They are important. If they don't talk about you, you yourself ask them what they are thinking about you. Let them talk about you, because through their talking, you can find your capacities, your weak points, your strong points, what become clear and clear for yourself, and through that you can decide for yourself, for your future more and best. Planning every day for your life. I do remember one of the young people wrote a letter to Allama Tabatabai that I'm living in a country that is full of sins and problems, and religiosity over there is not so strong. I cannot be a religious person in that society. Please advise me to do my best in this regard, to change my life. Allama Tabatabai wrote a very brief answer for that. He replies in this way. At the beginning of your day, when you're going to start your day, decide not to go astray, not to commit a sin, just during a day. Till the end of that day, one day, not more, decide not to commit sin, not to disobey Allah the Almighty. At the beginning of a day, through a day, or that day, try not to violate your promise to yourself. Because you promised to yourself that you're going to be a faithful person. Try not to violate your promise. Not to commit anything. At the end of that day, night, when you're going to go to the bed, think about whatever you did, whatever you said, to what you looked. So all of the things will be calculated at the end of the day. And then if you see that, alhamdulillah, you were so good person and believer, faithful one, and you respected your promise to yourself, then do shukr, alhamdulillah, praise to God. Oh God, thank you, because you helped me to be a reliable person in my own presence, not the others. Others are not so important. I can rely on myself. I can rely on my promise. If you see that now, you violated whatever you promised, then do tawbah, return back to Allah the Almighty by doing tawbah. Oh God, forgive me. I did something wrong. Not because I wanted to disobey you, no. I just couldn't, you know, be so strong against my soul that is all the time commanding whatever bad. Amaratan bisu. So if you practice this, you know, prescription next day and the upcoming days, then you can become sure little by little that change is happening. But you have to try. Inshallah, I ask Allah the Almighty to put us among the people, travelers, wayfarers toward Allah the Almighty, who were perfect people, such as Ahlul Bayt, such as Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha, and the other prophets, previous prophets, and enable us to change the situation that we live to the best one, inshallah rahman. Wa akhiru da'wana alhamdulillah rabbil alamin. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ومولانا محمد وعلى آله وسلم. اللهم صل على سيدنا وعلى آله وسلم.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Presidents presiding over recessions usually lose in a landslide, so why didn't Donald Trump? It is something of an axiom in American presidential election years that if the economy is in poor shape, the incumbent party will lose. And indeed, as Americans cast their votes on Tuesday, 3rd of November, The United States was facing a recession largely due to President Donald Trump's bungling pandemic response. While what little economic recovery had occurred since its dawn primarily benefited the upper class. Joe Biden, of course, won the election, but it wasn't a landslide win. The fact that the race was so close belies this old political adage. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Matthew Rosa and has been taken from the website Salon.com. The piece is titled, "Presidents Presiding Over Recessions Usually Lose in a Landslide. Why Didn't Trump?" Stay with us for more of Matthew Rosa's article. Presidents presiding over recessions usually lose in a landslide, so why didn't Donald Trump? It is something of an axiom in American presidential election years that if the economy is in poor shape, the incumbent party will lose. And indeed, as the American public cast their votes on Tuesday, 3rd of November, the United States was facing a recession largely due to President Donald Trump's bungling pandemic response. Whilst what little economic recovery had occurred since its dawn primarily benefited the upper class. Joe Biden, of course, won the election, but it wasn't a landslide win. The fact that the race was so close belies this old political adage. So what happened? Is the economy no longer the main concern for presidential voters, or was this year a special case? Interestingly, exit polls show Donald Trump still receives significant support from economy-minded voters, meaning many voters still see him as strong on the economy, despite economic data to the contrary. Perhaps the pandemic situation is seen as a special case, or perhaps Joe Biden was not perceived as strong on the economy, or as doing anything to help struggling Americans. Trump is an extreme blabbermouth, according to Dr. Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Dr. Wolff added, "He's offensive, I get all that, but out of his mouth comes what significant groups of our society want to hear, so he can achieve the normal Republican goals, which is an alliance between the servants of big business and enough members of the employee class to get them into power. So they can serve big business, that's the game." Dr. Richard Wolff contrasted this with the Democrats. Big business shells out the bucks that the Republican Party uses it to win the offices that will then give to their constituents. Anti-immigration, white supremacists, gun lovers, abortion haters, and everybody else they can collect. Give them what they want, and then you have the deal, Wolff explained. The Democratic Party is caught in a contradiction that it doesn't want to face. It goes to the same corporations and rich people for money, and they get money. But then, you can't be the champion of the employee class, because what the employee class wants is a direct threat to big business and the rich, and so you're stuck. As a result, Dr. Richard Wolff believes that Joe Biden took moderate positions on many issues, being caught in this contradiction. That, Wolff says, may have cost him voters. As Dr. Wolff noted, one secret to Donald Trump's success is that he's enlivening various members of his base, something that Joe Biden, in contrast, didn't really do. Trump is giving to the evangelicals more of what they want, is giving to the white supremacists more of what they want, more than all the previous Bush-type Republicans ever were. He has strengthened and rallied the collection of people Republicans always had, the gun enthusiasts, the opponents of abortion, all of that. Only he's made them more happy and more enthusiastic because he differentiates himself from the other Republicans precisely by being extreme. According to Richard Wolff, whatever policy Joe Biden gets behind, he does it moderately. He has always done that sort of thing, unless it's something where there is no opposition, like beating up on the Chinese or the socialists or whatever it is that has no political costs. Richard Wolff is not the only economic expert who has argued that ostensibly liberal parties suffer when they fail to support bold measures to help working-class voters. In 2018, French political economist Thomas Piketty wrote a paper which explained that parties claiming to be left-wing do not perform as well when their supposed support for the working class clashes with the perception that they are elitist. Whilst the Democratic Party in the United States and its closest counterparts in the United Kingdom and France, that is the Labour Party and the Socialist Party respectively, did well in the 1950s and 60s, when the vote for left-wing, socialist, Labour, Democratic parties was associated with lower education and lower income voters, over time those parties become associated with higher education voters. As a result, Thomas Piketty wrote, these countries developed a system of multiple elite parties where high education elites now vote for the left, whilst high income, high wealth elites still vote for the right, though less and less so. This has led to rising income inequality and the inability of democratic institutions to effectively address it. Just as ominous, it has paved the way for right-wing populists like Donald Trump, Nigel Farage in Britain, and Marine Le Pen in France. Without a strong egalitarian internationalist platform, it is difficult to unite low-education, low-income voters from all origins within the same party, Piketty observed. Other economists who spoke to Salon.com agreed that voters were concerned about the economy, yet somehow they did not blame Donald Trump. The pandemic tanked the economy, but many Trump voters didn't seem to blame the president for that, seeing it more as an act of God, said Dr. Gabriel Mathey, a macroeconomist at American University. Dr. Gabriel Mathey added, the economic recovery since 2009, while slow, has been steady and resulted in one of the hottest economies before the pandemic. Trump's tax cuts that benefited corporations and the very wealthy also boosted the stock market beyond the strong economy. So I don't think that there's much Biden could have done. Voters reward incumbent presidents for strong economic performance, and Donald Trump didn't seem to take much blame for the current recession. He added, presidents are also rewarded for stimulus packages, and Donald Trump was president when the CARES Act was passed, which was insufficient but still one of the most ambitious stimulus packages in U.S. history. Another economist who spoke to Salon.com echoed Dr. Gabriel Mathey's views. Even years from now, sweeping claims about what caused this election's outcome will be largely guesswork, Dr. Carl Weidequist, an American political philosopher and economist at Georgetown University's Qatar campus, wrote to Salon. It is possible that large numbers of people blame COVID-19 precautions rather than the lack of government relief for the cost of COVID-19 precautions. And perhaps Democrats could have done a better job of blaming Republicans for the failure to pass more economic stimulus. Salon.com also asked economic experts about the policies that will best help financially struggling and working-class voters. Given immediate needs, having more transfer to households and businesses through additional checks, paycheck protection programs, and expanded unemployment insurance would help alleviate the current situation, Gabrielle Matthey suggested. We will see if there is a stimulus package to be passed in the lame duck. McConnell may want to pass the package under Trump and then point to Biden's inability to pass a stimulus package in the 2022 midterms. McConnell also has more leverage now, as the House Democratic majority will be narrow and the Democrats will not take back the U.S. Senate. Dr. Ryderquist expressed similar views, writing to Salon that direct individual universal cash grants are the best response to emergency. They are a bonus to those who remain in work and a cushion for those who can't find work or can't work because of the crisis. All people have different needs. With cash, they're free to buy who they know and they know what they need. As people spend their bonuses, the money trickles up to business owners and investors who figure out how to provide people what they need at this time. He added, some proposals on the table included $2,000 per person per month for 4 to 6 months, or perhaps even longer if the crisis lasted longer. That would have been a great idea when the lockdown started, and it's still a good idea now. Dr. Richard Wolff told Salon that Americans need a modern-day equivalent of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, perhaps something akin to the Green New Deal proposed by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He specifically said that Americans need to improve their social security system so that those who live on it will not be poor, raising the minimum wage so that people can live off of it, including tying it to inflation, increasing unemployment insurance, and a federal jobs program. What in the world is going on that this is not part of our national discussion? How in the world does Joe Biden look himself in the face in the morning? After describing the success of Roosevelt's New Deal program, which created millions of jobs in response to the Great Depression of the 1930s, Dr. Wolff explained that we now have, depending on your estimates, 20 to 25 is in the Americans unemployed. They shouldn't be. They should be hired by the government tomorrow. The actual amount of money you have to pay them, if you paid them, isn't that much more than the state on unemployment and the federal supplement that are now in place. Only the difference would be a significant gain for them, some increase in the money they take home, and there's an enormous benefit to society in terms of all the work they can do.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.